I can afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and today I'm excited to present to you an episode featuring hosts David Wilde and Taylor Locke. Now, David is, of course, a friend of the show, as well as a writer and a producer of the upcoming television special Let's Go Crazy, the Grammy Salute to Prince, which airs this Tuesday, April 21st, from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on CBS. His co-host for this episode is producer-songwriter Taylor Locke, who is the former lead guitarist for Rooney. He also co-created and was the co-author of Don't Stop the Musical, which is a comedy about Fleetwood Mac that played here at Largo Theater in Los Angeles. Now, their guests for today are Susanna Hoffs, Jimmy Jam, Brad Paisley, and Phil Rosenthal. Susanna Hoffs is a beloved member of the Bangles as well as a solo artist. And on Tuesday's special, she's going to be singing a stripped-down version of Manic Monday with Chris Martin of Coldplay. Jimmy Jam, he's a famed producer with Terry Lewis and a former member of The Time. He's also musical director on The Salute, and he also performs with The Time on the show. Brad Paisley, country music superstar, guitar hero, and Prince fan. Simple as that. Phil Rosenthal is the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, as well as the star of Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix. So if you haven't guessed by now, these people are going to be discussing all things Prince. And with that, it's my pleasure to introduce Let's Get Crazy with Prince. So take it away, David Wilde and Taylor Locke.
Jimmy, I'll start with you. Since you literally go back to school days with Prince, how does it feel when you think back about that talented kid you met and you were another talented kid, that here we are, however many years later, probably better not to do the math, like, why is this guy worth saluting? This guy who, you saw his rise, you were part of his rise, then he fired you and set off your rise. Why is he an artist, the artist, worth saluting as we're doing on the Grammy special Tuesday night on CBS for the promotional value of that?
Yeah, you would definitely need a calculator to do the figures on how long ago junior high school was that we were together in. But the thing I would just say is, and I watched a special last night, and the thing that struck me was when you look at the audience that's there, and it's all races and all ages and people that wouldn't maybe necessarily have a lot in common with each other, but they all do on that night, on that show. And that to me is the gift that Prince gave us all. Is he made music that really truly united us and empowered us. And so I don't know. I mean, going back to that level, I'll tell you, I thought he was the most talented person that I'd ever met or ever seen when I met him. And I was 12, 13 years old, probably. And I remember that I thought I was I played keyboards, but not, I was a pretty good keyboard player. And he could play Rings Around Me. And I also remember we got in a school band together. And I said, I'll play drums. And he looked at me like, drums? I thought you played keyboards. And then he said, I'll play guitar. And I was like, guitar? And he ripped off the solo to Make Me Smile, Chicago, the Terry Cass solo. Just like killed it. Then he jumped on the drums and like, I didn't even want to play the drums after he got off the drums. So I knew the talent level that he had at an early age. And he was actually a really good basketball player too, believe it or not.
And to that point, I want to get into the basketball, but to the point, hey, Brad, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's nice to see all of you guys today.
Hi, Brad.
Everyone know Brad? Susanna, have you ever met Brad?
I don't know that we have.
No, we've never met. I would remember.
And Jimmy, I remember introducing you to Brad years ago, I think, but maybe you've known each other longer. But what Jimmy was saying was that what makes Prince worth saluting is the way he brings all sorts of people together. And one thing is, like, when I asked Brad, who is the most shit hot guitar player I know from the country world, or really most anywhere,
yeah,
he's like him. He's in my top five with Eddie Van Halen and Prince. But you immediately said Prince was a hero to you too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's an overused expression to say somebody's an underrated guitarist or an underrated anything. Underrated is tricky because it's underrated makes it seem like nobody knew. They knew he was amazing. It's just, he was so amazing and everything else. Just like Jimmy was saying, it's like we have a guy that, like, he was so tasteful is what it was. It's kind of like he reminded me in many ways of David Gilmour, because it's like he could play these notes. It's like there's this incredible other record going on. And then guitar comes in and it's screaming and it's crying and it's got Hendrix kind of influence to it. But without, like, you know, Hendrix played all over his records. Prince, it's like, here comes the guitar. When it was time for the guitar, it was perfect. And that becomes underrated in the sense that, you know, he wasn't showing off. He was just being masterful every time he played a note, you know?
And David, can I just add to that?
Please.
Part of the reason that I think he's probably underrated somewhat as a guitar player is because, to me, what always stuck out about Prince was his rhythm guitar playing. And that's not the flashy solo stuff. Right. But that's like, if you listen to a song like Controversy, is a great example, where it's basically just a four on the floor kick drum, boom, 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 boom. That's not necessarily funky. As soon as Prince starts playing, it's like, oh my God, like all of a sudden it turns into the funkiest groove in the world. And that was the thing that Prince had. Freddie Stone had that from Sly and the Family Stone. And that was one of Prince's, you know, gurus, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
but as a rhythm player, that to me was the thing. But then the thing that was surprising about Prince, I think that's why people were so blown away at the Hall of Fame induction, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, because they hadn't really heard him play like that in that type of thing. And it was like, it was mind-blowing. But like Brad said, he never necessarily showed off with it. It wasn't like it's all over my records. It was just one piece of what he did.
I will say that Hall of Fame is the one time where I feel like he did want to show. It's like
he wanted to burn the house down.
Yes.
He was like, okay, move out of the way. I'm going to show you guys what I got. And then then that was it. It was like,
yeah, right.
Mic drop.
Question.
Yeah. I have a question.
Where did the guitar go?
Somebody caught it.
Someone was waiting up there for it?
No clue where that's at.
That's the magic of Prince.
God.
I experienced that, when he used to show up at Bangles gigs, and the way we discovered each other was that the week that I heard When Doves Cry, somebody let me know that Prince had just heard the Bangles' first single, Hero Takes a Fall, and then suddenly he would just be at the shows. And the first time he walked out on stage and just, first of all, the guitar just felt like it was part of him, like just an extension of his body. You know, it was so a part of him. And then he would start soloing on that song. Mm-hmm. And like Jimmy said, it was like so rhythmic, but it was like channeled from somewhere inside and coming out. And in this way that was, I don't know, it was all improvisational, but it was so rhythmic and so supernatural almost to me. I had never seen or heard anybody play where the guitar was a part of their body and their soul, you know. It was like, and it was just so in the moment and so, I don't know, so deep, coming from a place, you know, and also so free, so much just the poetry of like just not knowing what the next note or rhythm would be, but it was just this, it was a magical thing to witness. I never in my life experienced that again. I've never been on a stage with a musician and experienced that.
I was watching him on stage with you and the Bangles on YouTube, and it's crazy great. Was that like, basically he started showing up, and then after a while, did he slip you an envelope with Manic Monday, or what was that? How did that happen?
Well, that was from the, Hero Takes a Fall was from our first album. And then when David and Peggy Leonard, who had worked with Prince as engineers, were at that, we were recording at the same time, Prince at Sunset Sound and the Bangles at Sunset Sound Factory, the sister studio. We were working with David Leonard, and Prince was being engineered by Peggy Leonard. So word got to through David that Prince had a song, and would I drive over to Sunset Sound and get it? But when I showed up, it was like this incredible thing of just driving over there and thinking, you know, we're going to chat and everything. But the cassette, I still have the same cassette that, wow, you know, that I picked up, was there at the front desk because he was in the middle of recording. But that said, that's how it came about. I think it started with Hero Takes a Fall and him liking the band and then playing with us on stage and then having this thought to give us Manic Monday.
Has that demo ever been released?
The Prince demo came out on the Originals collection that just came out, last year, yeah.
The cassette needs the same. That needs to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I went to a storage unit to get it because I thought, I know I have the actual cassette, but I had moved and I had stuck some things in storage, and sure enough, there it was.
Wow.
And yeah.
And Phil, you were there at the, Phil was, I gave my one or my two free tickets to Phil and his wife, Monica, who, you know, who everyone loves since Everybody Loves Raymond, and everyone knows Phil from Netflix. But so you were there. One of the greatest moments in the show for me, and I think for a lot of people, once they see it Tuesday on CBS, is you did Manic Monday with Chris Martin. And the great thing about that performance, and there's many, you were always great, but the thing that I love about it is you literally reinvent this great beloved song is totally reinvented and takes on a new resonance that because of the show. I should point out the Prince Let's Go Crazy, the Grammy Salute to Prince, which is airing 4 days to the year, four years to the day that we lost Prince. And I think that makes this song have a whole new meaning, and the performance is so beautiful. What can you tell us a little bit about what went so right with it, Susanna?
Well, when you contacted me, I said, "Can we talk?" And you told me that Chris had picked Manic Monday, and I was very touched by that because I'm a huge fan of his, and I love Coldplay, and I admire him so much. And so then you and I talked, and I said, you know, I'd really like to get together with him and talk about it. And we did. And he had been traveling, and I went out to his place, and we sat down, and he told me the reason he picked it was because it was the first song as a young, I guess he was only, I think he was born in like the late 70s. So he must have been quite young, less than 10 years old when he heard it. But he somehow knew that even though it was the Bangles version of it, because there was no other version at that time, he knew it was a Prince song. Somebody told him this song was written by Prince. And so he picked the song that had this very special memory for him as a young kid in love with music. It just so happened to be our version of Prince's song. So when we got together, my whole thought was that I don't necessarily want to try to duplicate a record. The thought that I had an opportunity to sing this song with Chris, I just wanted to figure out what could we do to make it as emotional and powerful of an experience as two Prince lovers coming together to make something new. And so I couldn't have gone better, in my opinion, because we sat right next to each other on the piano bench. He started playing it. He never played it the same way twice, ever. And it was like one of those things that I long for as a musician, of just being in the total present tense moment with another musician, listening to each other, not stuck with our in-ear monitors and our, you know, all the gear and trying to hear each other, but like close and looking at each other and playing together. And it was just like doing a dance with somebody. He never played it the same way twice. We never sang it the way, same way twice. And at the venue, when we performed it, obviously I was very nervous. I don't play venues of that size typically, or I hadn't in a very, very long time. And I felt like I was like walking this tightrope. It was so delicate. And on the heels of Misty Copeland, the ballerina who knew Prince well, her beautiful, beautiful intro in which she talked about how Prince wrote for women a lot and really liked to. And then it was right at a part of the show. I don't want to give anything away, though, am I?
You're not giving anything away. No, I can't wait for the world to see this, because Phil, you saw it. Jimmy, you saw it. It reinforced for me something that, working with Ken Ehrlich, you know, who's produced the Grammys and these specials forever, what I've always noticed is the most powerful moments are often the ones that aren't the biggest moment. But it's when you take it back down to the essence of music and just have a pure musical conversation. And that's what it is like, I have to say, the song just took on a whole new meaning that it and I don't know if you remember this. I walked up on stage, which I don't do as much as like Ken or someone, but I remember asking Chris to say, your vocal was so beautiful. And you, by the way, you look so beautiful in this special. and then there's Chris who dressed casual and is real loose. And yet it has total, you lock in to this sort of magical moment. And it's, as you said, it's not, there's no artifice. It's just pure, really feeling a song.
And I really wanted Chris to sing "The Time It Goes So Fast," because even thinking of that as it relates to Prince and that he's gone, and it happened so, it was such a shock for all of us when that happened, when he passed. And I just, the way Chris, even him reinventing the melody. And I said, do it twice, sing it twice, I think, because it was so touching to me. I mean, the song took on a whole another meaning in a certain way for me. So hopefully people will enjoy that. And
do you know, it's interesting what you said about you guys just listening to each other instead of monitors, because I heard from Michael Bland, the drummer who played with Prince a lot, that they didn't use any monitors whatsoever, and he forbid anyone in the band to, and they just had the front of house mix, little fills pointed back at them. So everybody, they were forced to, they didn't even have a monitor engineer. No, nothing. It was just what the crowd was hearing they had in fills. And so if you needed to hear more of yourself, it was, you know, only when it was your time to feature would you be able to do that. You just had to be in the fabric of the music and not have some, you know, custom experience where you're hearing yourself on top of the band.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Jimmy, I had a question about when you were saying early on how he was already so talented on multiple instruments. How was he inclined in this time when people weren't recording at home yet and you didn't have one man band things like, you know, Stevie Wonder or McCartney or Todd Rundgren, like how did he get the idea that he should, was he just compelled to do everything because no one else was going to be able to do it the way he wanted it? I mean, the way he was hands-on with engineering and production it was like a French filmmaker, like an auteur, where everything comes from one mind. You know, not that he couldn't collaborate and didn't have great collaborations, but how do you think he got this inkling to do everything, be this all-arounder?
Well, first of all, he had opportunity, and opportunities to me such a key word here, because, you know, he gave us such a great opportunity to go out. When I say us, I mean myself and Terry, to go out and do what we did. But I think the big thing with Prince was he had access to a studio. There was a guy in Minneapolis named Chris Moon who had a studio. I think it was a 16-track studio. And he used to allow Prince to just go in and just create. And I think that was such a key for him to experiment Because when you talk about, yes, he knew how to engineer, he knew how to get his sounds, to play his instruments, to get his effects, all those things. But he had access to a studio that he could just literally just go in and just play. And he would do it. He would play like all night. Like he literally was always been, I never knew when he slept. He would always be up playing and always doing stuff and call at, you know, 2 a.m. and let's go do this and that type of thing. So I think that was the thing that really shaped the idea of him being able to do it himself. And I think obviously influenced by people like Stevie Wonder, people like Todd Rundgren, who were making records at that point in time where they were doing everything themselves. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it.
Brad, when you were growing up, like, you know, I know you were, you know, a kid phenomenon playing like on the West Virginia version of the Opry, but did Prince still enter your mental consciousness, musical reality at all?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I was no phenomenon. I was I was good for 13. And my dad used to say, you're cute, but when you're 19, you're not going to be cute anymore at this. So make sure at 21, you're good.
I think you're still cute.
Thanks. Thanks, David. By the way, where are you vacationing, David? That looks wonderful.
I think I'm somewhere in Hawaii, but I might switch to, you know, somewhere less glamorous later.
Here's the thing. It's like I grew up, my first taste of music was Buck Owens, who reminds me of Prince in a weird way, because Buck was a maverick and did a lot himself and wouldn't play by the rules and also did not have a monitor engineer. You know, they did Buck Owens live at Carnegie Hall. They hadn't really even invented monitors yet. And that thing sounds like they auto-tuned it. It's crazy. And it's like, and you know, but then I slowly over time, like as I was born in 72. So I was 8 when the 80s rolled around and already playing the guitar and going through, you know, being influenced by everything. Like we had the country station was WWBA, which is legendary country, one of the oldest country stations in America, one of the first two. And then the rock station was Womp FM. And on that, so I was bouncing. So I was already like country for a little while during the day and listening to some rock. And I was way into the Huey Lewis and the Bangles and Prince and Springsteen and everything else in addition, because that was a survival act as well, so that I didn't get beat up in school. and you know, and it was like, because, you know, going to school and, you know, rocking at that time, rocking George Jones, Johnny Cash records, they'd, you know, nobody thought that was cool at that point. But with Prince, it was like, it was immediate. Like he just grabbed you with the song. And as a guitar player, I had to later on realize what he was doing. The song came first. It was crazy what he could do. And, you know, I was watching the other day where they did, where it was like a high school. Oh, I know what it was. It was Dave Chappelle's Mark Twain Award. Did you guys see that?
Yes, and the band came down the aisle.
Oh my God, his high school band.
Yes, it was fantastic.
It's unbelievable. It was like, that was exactly what Prince, I would think, would have wanted. Was that his song to live on with the life of a high school. And marching. It's like, this. How many people's songs shine through when a marching band does it? No one. I mean, you know, it's like, usually when a marching band covers a song, I remember when I went to a West Virginia football game and the marching band would cover Country Roads. And I would like, I took my grandpa to his first WVU game. And I nudged him. I'm like, there it is. There's Country Roads. And he's like, that ain't Country Roads.
Well, that marching band, how many marching bands can cover Prince? They were pretty great.
No, it would be true. So yeah, I mean, anybody's song sounds good with that band, but no, it was like, I honestly, for me, it was amazing the way the song came first with him. And every song he ever wrote that I ever heard was amazing. And it's like, I hear there's this treasure trove of unreleased stuff somewhere that we all know is probably great. He'd probably hate it if it's released, but it's probably insanely better than anything anyone else is doing. And I hope, I don't know if that'll ever see the light of day. Does anybody know?
Jimmy would know if anyone would know.
Yeah.
What do you think? Have you heard it yet?
I think some of that stuff will see the light of day. Some of it has seen the light of day. Unfortunately, in some cases, it's been kind of misguided, even in the intent of what the songs were for or who they were for. Mm-hmm. When we talked to Prince, probably 10 years ago, we had a conversation with Prince, and we had our studio, and Prince said, I just want to come to your studio and just make a record. And we said, okay, great. And he said, what kind of record would you make? And we said, first of all, we go to the vault and we grab all that stuff you were making around when we were there, which was the early 80s. He had tons of great songs and great music, but it wasn't necessarily for him. It was intended for the time. It was intended for Sheila E. It was intended for Vanity Six at the time. And those were the songs we were like, let's go back and grab those songs. And so some of those things have gotten released, but the story on what they are and who they were intended for and how they would have actually been finished, mm-hmm. I think has gotten lost a little bit in the translation. But yeah, that stuff, you will hear a lot of it, and he won't be happy about it. Quite honestly. Not be happy about it.
Just say that all of it was intended for the Bengals and send it to Susanna's.
There you go.
Exactly.
There you go. Well, and I'm sure some of it was. That's the whole point. He was always inspired by other people, and he would always write with other people in mind, and had a lot of records. The song If I Were Your Girlfriend song was actually, he did a record, and I can't remember what it was called now. Oh my God, I just blanked on it. He did a whole album of songs like that with the sped up voice.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a name. Camille. Yes. I think it was Camille.
Yeah. He did a whole album of that kind of stuff. And that was the thing. When you talk about how prolific he was, he literally, it wasn't even about, oh, I'm going to write songs for myself. It's like, I'm just going to create other entities and other, ways to get this music out. Very much like George Clinton back in the day with Parliament and Funkadelic and Bootsy and all of these different things. It all came from George's mind, but then it got spread in a million different ways.
Well, he created you, and then that created a monster of your whole career, right? The timer on the show reunited with Morris Day, sounding amazing. But can you talk about how did he change your life that way?
Well, he changed my life totally. Like, the reason that we're even here today speaking is because of him. There's a documentary on Netflix that I would recommend everybody see called The Black Godfather. And it's about Clarence Avon, who was very important in our lives. But the thing was, at the beginning of the documentary, the first person that speaks is Bill Withers. And Bill Withers talks about that person that creates the opportunity for you is the most important person that you have. I mean, you still have to go on your own and do it and make it happen. Prince for us was that opportunity. And when he made it out of Minneapolis, it gave us all in Minneapolis inspiration, like, oh, we can do it. We can do it. So when he came back and basically said, he told Morris, put a band together and I'll get you a record deal. Because Morris had written a song called Party Up for him. And Prince said, okay, for writing this song, I'll put a band together. But he didn't want our band to be the band, actually. He wanted the band that Morris already had, which was a different band. But we were the better band. And I think that was the thing that came back to drive him crazy, was when he picked us for the band, Morris kind of held his ground and said, no, I want Jimmy and Terry and these guys to be the band. So he put us in the band. And then when we got on tour, and there were nights we'd just kick his ass, just flat out fast. And I remember one time we came in after one really spectacular gig that we had, and I don't remember the city. And Morris's jacket that he always wore, the Presley, and we called it the Presley. So Morris wanted a new Presley, and Prince said, no, you got to wear the old one because that's what everybody expects you to wear. So Morris went and got his own Presley made. After the show, Prince walks into the dressing room afterwards, and we're all just kind of, kicking it and stuff. And he goes, hey, he says, Jerome, bring me my thing. And so Jerome brings out this garment bag. He zips open the garment bag, and Morris Day says, "Hey, Prince, I got a new Presley." And Prince looks at us and goes, "I created a monster," and ran out of the dressing room. So that was the thing. So he gave us the opportunity, man, and that was the biggest thing. But then he taught us the work ethic, man. The work ethic was incredible because he outworked everybody. And so, but he also out-talented everybody. And that was the combination that was unbelievable.
And when you talked about, oh, by the way, Phil, I wanted to ask you, that sounded like we were in a special director's cut of Purple Rain. When Phil has a famous legendary movie night that you're now all, if it ever comes back, if we ever don't have to socially distance, you're all going to come, we'll screen Purple Rain.
Yes,
but that'd be great. But Phil, for you, what do you think? I've never been able to explain how, there's a million things about Prince I don't think are, how do you explain a guy who I towered over, who my wife, who's 5'1", towered over, who somehow was sort of, you know, sort of looked ambiguous racially, sexually, who was from Minneapolis, which he made the coolest place on earth, but was previously just the coldest place on earth. How does that guy not only become like the best thing since the Beatles in some ways, or the biggest, and then make Purple, how does he make Purple Rain, which, and again, I'm not going to argue this for the subsequent movies, but he makes like this auteurish, he hires a guy who's never done this. How did Purple Rain work out so well?
You're asking me, the old Jew?
Yes, exactly. You're a creative genius. You brought the
role. I'll tell you, and this is something that I'm so happy to be with real musicians who understand what he did. But as a guy who can't play a note and is just a fan, and yet I toil in my little world of writing comedy and my little food show and everything. But when I work with great chefs or great comedy writers, there's one thing we're all looking for, whether you're a musician or any other art form. It's one word, it's undeniable. And he was undeniable. You just can't, if you're writing a song, you know when it's undeniable, right? There's certain ones, you know, and certain jokes that we may have, well, we'll see how it works. We'll see, or if a chef, I think this dish has the right ingredients and I think it tastes pretty good. We'll see what the people say. And then there's the one that's undeniable. That's Prince. Okay. I've never been so sad at an artist's passing that as I was with him. It's still, there's a void in my heart. And I can't even say that I listened to him every day, but I knew that he was undeniable. There was one of a kind. And I was in love with his music writing, music playing, music singing, his dancing, we're not even talking about. Yeah. The dancing? He was a showstopper.
He could do that guitar solo you're talking about that's insane and split at the same time.
Well, it's interesting, David, you started talking about his physicality. I was wondering, Jimmy, about like his energy, these all-nighters in the studio, and then these stories about he'd play at an arena and then turn up and do a secret gig after. Like, where did he ever, like, you know, crash? Like, how did that energy sustain itself? Was he like manic and sped up, or was it just like a marathon of energy? Because these stories about him playing the after gig, you know, there's so many of them, and he's this little guy, and you know, you hear about Mick Jagger's like fitness and health routine. Like, what, how did Prince sustain the like raw energy to
he was
kind of hours?
You know what, I really don't know, but I know that back in our rehearsal days, what would happen is he'd come and rehearse our band. The time he'd rehearse us for 5 or 6 hours, and he would just, you know, relentlessly, not with, I mean, he'd be like, you know, make this louder, make this softer, change the key of this, do that. I mean, it was very intense. Then he'd leave and go do the Revolution. He'd go and then work them for another 6 hours. Then he'd go to the studio, or which was even before Paisley Park, in his house or whatever. And the next day, he would walk into our rehearsal, the time rehearsal, with a cassette. And he'd pop it in and he'd say, "This is what I did last night." And it would be 1999. Like, right. It would, I mean, I'll never forget when he popped 1999 in and it came in, dun, 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 with the blues and everything. And we were like going, what the heck? And something went off. We were, okay, let's hit 7779311. Like, he'd be right straight into like our rehearsal. Like, wow. He, that was the energy he had. 20 wow. Hours a day.
Yeah, the day I met him, well, I met him, I went to cover the Love Sexy tour opening in Paris. And he did the big arena, you know, a show. And then he had an after party, and it was very Prince-like. And it was, I don't know where there's a place like this, but it was in the middle of like a park in Paris on water. So it felt like you were on an island. And I was brought over with Kurt Loder, who was covering this for MTV. The two of us were brought over. Kurt stepped on his foot, which, as awkward as Prince could be in conversation, it didn't help that Kurt stepped on his foot. But still, at the end of the conversation, he goes, very brief conversation, he was a man of few words in many ways, he said, "Do you want to see me play later?" And it was 3 a.m. at this point, and wow. Later was 4:30 at a club off the Champs-Élysées. I found the set list the other day. He went on and did like a great show again with Mavis Staples, who's on our Grammy special.
She's
and
amazing.
And by the way, Jimmy knows, I fought for her. I guess that we have to have Mavis, because he yeah. Personally once told me how much he loved Mavis, and I thought, she needs to be there.
Oh, no, she's great in this show.
And yeah. Sheila E. was the band whose musical directors are Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, and Sheila E. for great. This show. And you guys did an amazing job. You were, yeah. Susanna, you were saying the other day when we spoke just what you were impressed with the musical direction, because they have, there's a high standard to live up to.
Yeah, I mean, but I was just thinking about the thing about Prince just constantly going and being in the act of making music in some way. And it had to just be like, almost like a drug-like effect when you're playing music, all that other noise about your life and your problems just goes away because you're in that moment, you know, you're just playing, right? But I remember this one night, you just reminded me, when he invited the Bangles to go to Sunset Sound, where he was kind of encamped, recording Jimmy was saying, and you know, just always going from this thing to that to recording. And Peggy Leonard used to say you could always tell Prince was doing his vocals sometimes by himself, because you could just hear his boots clacking on the wood floor. He would be engineering himself, you know, and just in there at 3 a.m. recording his vocals. But so we went into his studio and we just didn't know what to expect, but in the end, he just wanted to play Bangles songs. And the crazy thing was, and it was like the biggest compliment ever, he knew all of them. So we just went to Sunset Sound at like 1 a.m, and I don't remember what time it ended. First, we went to his house that he was renting, and that was really interesting. But then we all went over to Sunset Sound. I look back on it, and I can't even believe, it's like, was that a dream? No, it actually happened. That we just played music with Prince, and we were playing our songs, and he knew them, and that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to play Bangles songs.
Do you remember after you cut Manic Monday, did he come around while you were working on it?
No, he didn't come around when we were working on it. He came to when we were rehearsing to go on tour, which was just right after we finished the record. And all of a sudden, and this would be very typical of Prince, like when he just be backstage suddenly at a show. No warning, he just materialized, you know, like in this very surprising but, you know, kind of incredible way. There was like this kind of euphoric feeling. Oh my God, Prince is in the building, you know, and but he just showed up and we were like panicked because no one in the band played keyboards. It was a guitar-based band. And so we didn't know how to do the iconic Baroque riff of the song. And he just sort of listened to it and he had this kind of mischievous look on his face. And then he was like, yeah. I mean, because we didn't use his tracks, I guess was the point. He had given us him singing in the same key, but his recording, his tracks. And we just kind of start it over again and fangle-fied it, you know, from the ground up, and just recorded our own drums and bass and, you know, built our own track. So we had a sudden anxiety that he would be a little bit bummed or something that we didn't use his tracks, but he was into it.
The mischievous quality you just mentioned, I realized that's actually, that's why I think of him and the Beatles in a certain way. Like they're a great artist, Stevie Wonder, you know, I can think of other great artists, but to me, the Beatles and Prince both had a wink, a mischievous wink that makes it feel very modern. He's gone 4 years and you look at things he said, and I think back to the conversations I had with him. I mean, I had one where I tried to pitch him a joke, which was I'll never forget that.
How did that go?
It's like when I pitched you, I saw Todd today.
Oh yeah, I bet. It
didn't always go well.
Out. I've seen it. But, you're not a bat in a thousand when it comes to that.
But I did write the last, it's in the Grammy show. There's this moment where he said that albums still matter, like Black Lives, that we wrote together. And I always think, I have a collaboration with, not as good as Manic Monday, not as good as the Time records, but it's something. But I did have the experience. I think maybe because he was like at 5 foot whatever and 98 pounds or whatever, he had to win, which he did. He always wanted to win. He had like in that While My Guitar Gently Weeps moment, he had to do surprise attacks. And like, I had the same experience. You know, he called Ken Ehrlich and I over to meet, to discuss the Beyonce Grammy moment that ended up opening the Grammys and being a big moment in his career. That, the Super Bowl, and While My Guitar Gently Weeps are big moments in my mind.
Yeah.
But he literally called us over last minute and we sat with him, had a meeting where he was fascinating to speak with. He was funny. He was sharp. But then he did his surprise attack, which was, he goes, "You guys want a little private concert?" And it was like, he literally had two seats brought over in the rehearsal hall, and he and the band did a show for two of us.
What?
And in the show at that little club in Paris, those will always be the greatest shows I ever saw. Maya Rudolph, who does a beautiful job hosting the show, said, as a live performer, it's not even close. It's like, I still think, I've never seen anyone do what he did, you know? And like, to your point, undeniable, Phil. My wife is not like a music person, not particularly. And I remember seeing at the Forum his show, not the Forum, I'm sorry, at Staples when he came and
was
playing in the round. And she said, "This is clearly the greatest thing I've ever seen." And
yes.
And she didn't know probably half the songs, you know.
And this, that part where he just sits with just him and the guitar doing versions of his hit just on the acoustic guitar, pretty great.
Well, that's actually a good question for the two guitarists, Taylor and Brad. One thing I was interested when I was...
Susanna, three guitars.
And Susanna, I'm sorry. I was just trying to get to the guys, appeal to them at some level. when I was studying his life again and just wallowing in the music while we were working on this special, I realized that when he almost was a little bored with the guitar at the end. Like, he was so brilliant at it. He had the piano tour. I think he had sort of fallen in love with the piano, which, again, he could have fallen in love with any instrument because he was one of those guys like Stevie Wonder or McCartney who just could excel in any instrument. But what is it?
Yeah.
Does it amaze you? Because it's sort of like, it amazes you that a guitarist, you know, as good as Prince, could have certain way fallen out of love with guitar a little?
What amazes me is that somebody who is that good of a player, you know, Susanna mentioned the Baroque melody, Manic Money, that like major seventh figure, and then Jimmy's mentioning 5-6 hour rehearsals, that he could be like a benevolent guy. If you're that good and you can do everything that well yourself, I mean, you guys know, Brad, you're a soloist, you're a band leader. If somebody's hitting clams in a rehearsal, it's irritating. It's going to piss you off. It's hard to like be a nice guy when somebody's not on your getting it done on that level. And since nobody can get it done on his level, I'm just curious about how he conducted himself collaboratively in touring and in rehearsals. You know, like he's that good. How does somebody get a gig to be in that band, and what do you have to do to get fired from that band? Like, how did he run his his show because
Jimmy, you were fired. So why don't you speak to that?
I heard a rumor. Tell me if this is true, and then I got to hop off here for another thing. But the rumor I heard was that he would fine band members for clams. Like when they would make a clam, they'd get he'd fine them monetarily. Is that true? I doubt it, but
I heard that about Ray Charles.
James Brown did that.
Yeah, well, maybe that's where he got it. If he did it, I don't. Do you know if he did it, Jimmy?
I'm sorry, you broke up on my end. If he did what?
Fined band members for making mistakes, like clams. Like they would get like a monetary fine. Like I'm taking this much out of your check this week.
He used to say that, but I don't know whether he ever did that.
I hope he did. I like thinking he did that. It's cool.
But you're also hearing that he went into the Bengals rehearsal and they were doing it not exactly the way he had laid it down and he was cool with it. So, I mean, maybe it's, I don't know. How do you be that good and also be a nice guy who can work with other people? If I was that good, I'd be a dick to everyone.
I think he could be difficult. That was my impression. He was.
Oh, I think so. Probably. Yeah. I didn't know him, but I bet he was.
I think there were nicer guys. There were guys who were probably more generous. I think in Jimmy's case, and Brad, if you have to go, you go. But you had the good fortune to have other opportunities that he was, I guess, somewhat threatened by or jealous of, or he pushed you out like knowing you could fly. But he was tough on band members they didn't stick. There weren't that many people who stuck around for the whole journey.
Yeah, that's true. And it's interesting because there's a lot of people that are kind of bitter about that. You know, we were never bitter. Like even when we got fired, we always just felt like Terry always called it freed, that he didn't fire us. He freed us to do what we needed to do.
I'm going to use that from now on. That's good to know.
Yeah. He was difficult, but you know, the one thing I will say is that what he expected from you was never above what he expected for himself. So the fact that he worked so hard and you saw the time and the effort and the joy that he got out of it, if someone wasn't getting that same thing out of it or putting that amount of work into it, then I think that really pissed him off.
Oh yeah.
And that was the one thing I'll say, that we loved it. We loved the work. We loved the rehearsals. We didn't complain. We thought it was great. And it showed us exactly what we needed to do to be successful on our own. The lessons are there. He was a great teacher. The lessons were there. It was just whether you were absorbing them or not. We were. We took everything that he did. And for us, it was either we're going to do it just like that, or sometimes the lesson would be, if we get it, we're not going to do it like that. But still, it was very informative.
Yeah.
Did you ever see him work himself to exhaustion? Do you think he could have taken better care of himself? Was he fragile because of the how hard he worked?
Later on in life, I know that he had, because he wore, you know, high heel shoes all the time, and I know he had hip problems and he had some other problems like that. And Morris Day got a hip replacement a while back, which Morris had changed his life. He said, and he told Prince, he said, "Man, you got to do this." He said, "It'll change your life." And I don't know whether Prince ever did or not, but I know that there was a point where he was walking around with a cane, and we always thought it was just because he was doing the pimp move or whatever, and he's going to have the cane. But, you know, I think it sometimes he actually maybe needed it. And a lot of time toward the end where he was doing the piano and the microphone stuff and not doing all the acrobatics and stuff that he had done before, that maybe at that point his health was, physical health had deteriorated to a point. But back when we were with him during the 80s period, no, there was never any hint of exhaustion at any point in time. I don't know that I'd ever seen him like yawn.
Wow. So, and I just wanted to ask you, you were in the audience for this show, and yes. I wanted to know what was that like for you?
Hey, Dan, before you do, I got to bow out because I got another thing I got to get on. I've loved this, though, you guys. Thank you for having me.
Love seeing you, Brad.
Oh, by the way, and I, all of you, Brad has a new hit called No Other Here that is something has to save the world, and it is saving at least.
Well,
so check it out.
I'll sign off with this. His reach was unbelievable. This hillbilly is a good example of the various strange ways that other formats were touched by him, and he was amazing. So I'm honored to have talked about him with you guys.
He actually wrote a song for Kenny Rogers that I only discovered in later years. That is great.
Did Kenny cut it?
Yes, Kenny cut it.
Wow. Awesome. Well, they're up there singing it together now.
Yep, exactly.
And Prince is telling him he didn't do it right. All right, I'll see you guys later. God bless.
Thank
Good
you,
luck.
Brad. All right,
Brad.
Yeah.
So I was asking Phil about the show because I know that for Jimmy and I, it was like, I think we both were like, oh boy, how do we make this something he would have hated as the least possible amount?
I loved every second. I loved every second. And I bet you guys there watching the other artists and then watching the clips of Prince in between, it was a beautiful tribute, I thought.
And those packages with the voiceover by Jimmy.
Yes.
Taylor, for you as a guitarist, did he have an influence on you, or you're young enough that was he a formative influence?
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was the context that he put around his guitar playing, because he was kind of coming from a Hendrix place, but like Brad said, the guitar had its moment, and it was always about the song, though, and his production was so ahead of its time and the writing was so good. And then the guitar came in and had its moment and it was dazzling. But instead of taking the Hendrix thing and copying the whole shebang in terms of that production and that era, it wasn't like Hendrix in a retro way. It was like taking Hendrix's kind of stylings, but then he's interested in synthesizers and Lynn drum machine and new effects. So he was kind of paying homage to his hero, but putting a whole new thing around it, a whole new context around it. And that influenced me, because sometimes all guitar players or musicians, you get stuck in a rut, you have your go-to patterns, and sometimes you think like, well, that's the same fucking Joe Walsh lick I've been playing since high school, but maybe that's all I'm gonna do is play that thing. But if I play it over something, mixing natural sounds with synthetic sounds, mixing old technology and new technology, it gave him a canvas to do that kind of guitar playing where it seemed anything but dated. It wasn't like he was just sort of doing Hendrix over again. He was doing it for his era.
Well, it's not even in guitar wise, but I will say, I just remember when I heard Little Red Corvette for the first time.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've never heard synthesizers sound so sexy and human. Like there was something like I think he was a man who loved sex. That comes across loud and clear in the music, but there was a sensuality to the way he touched instruments, and you feel it in a way. Like there's a lot of British synth rock that like it couldn't be less sexy, but Prince's music, it was sensual and human. Like he found the heart in the machine somehow. He found.
How about Kiss? The first time you heard Kiss.
Oh, yeah, that was right? Wild.
By the way, I'll say best falsetto ever in a song.
Yeah, it's funny. You even forget. You talk about everything. We haven't even really spoken much about him as a singer. Was there anything he couldn't do? Jimmy, you would know.
The thing that Terry always used to tease him about, because he used to tease us about being producers. He'd always laugh that, you know, you guys are producers. And he'd laugh. And Terry would always say to him, Prince, when you produce something that doesn't sound like you, then you're a producer. And Prince never had a comeback for that, because his touch on everything, you know that it's him if he's in the studio and if he's actually doing it. So I don't know. The thing, what you guys were talking about earlier, though, that I wanted to just think about was his vocals. he, on his first album, For You, which he played all the instruments, did all the vocals, engineered it. He pretty much did everything himself. But that starts off as an a cappella, almost choirish thing that he's like the voices. And it's like, I don't know, 20 or voices of him. That's the most amazing thing. And I was not arguing, but having a discussion with Questlove about it. And I said, if you were ranking debut albums by artists, I said the For You album by Prince, the first one that most people don't know, because most people came in, you know, around Purple Rain or 1999 or maybe Controversy or maybe Dirty Mind. But if that first album is so revelatory, and what I said to him was, think about that album. If you listen to the album, there's a moment on the album or moments on the album where you're going to go, man, who's playing guitar on that? Oh, it's Prince. Oh, man, who's playing that bass? That bass is funky. Oh, that's Prince. Oh, man, who's doing that background vocal? Oh, that's Prince. It's like literally every sonic thing you hear is him. And you realize,
and how old is he doing drummer, that?
Huh? He played every instrument. On the first album.
How old was he?
He was like 19 was or 20.
18, I think. Wow. I think he was 18.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But it's an amazing listen. So go back. If you don't know that and you haven't heard the album, go back and listen in that context of it. Because there's acoustic guitar songs, there's rock songs, it's like the whole gamut is right there. Like all the seeds of what were to come are all on that very first album. To me, it's one of the best debut albums that anybody's ever done.
And Susanna, you mentioned Peggy Leonard before, but one thing that blew my mind when I was sort of going back and listening to everything was realizing, and I tried to put it into Misty's comments, but like, I can't think of it. Like here in 2020, we're talking about the lack of women producers and engineers. Still, it's still a problem. Prince worked with women in every way. Like he obviously there's the sexuality of Prince, but he also was a man who loved women artistically, creatively, and who gave women. Like, is there any other male artist who ever had decades of working in a studio alone creatively with women?
None that I know. I mean, I just keep going back and listening to what everybody's saying. And Jimmy, you had so much time with Prince and worked so well the entire
time. I can go in the other room.
But just that the being in process with music, to me, I listen to Let's Go Crazy kind of as a morning hymn, you know, kind of it just gets my head straight. It's like we're gathered here to get through this thing called life. And then that song, I mean, I kind of just keep going back to the thought that Prince, it was his religion. It was the thing that, you know, he was like a kid in a candy store when he was doing that album and layering on all those parts and just being absolutely in the moment of the process of like, ooh, I'm going to now throw on an acoustic guitar. Ooh, let me put on the, I'm hearing a tambourine, track. I'm going to throw that on. Like, you know, I mean, for me, music is listening to music, playing music. I mean, music's a big part of my life. It is a religious experience. I mean, it is the closest thing that I have to like religion. It is the morning prayer. It's the midday prayer. It's the, you know, every song. It's the soundtrack of my life, you know, all the music that I love. And I just have to think, you know, almost more than anyone I've ever encountered actually in my life, Prince. Of course, all of us musicians know what that feels like, but Prince really lived his life. And though it was cut very short, he really, that was his, you know, his, I don't know, his, not, I don't want to say coping mechanism. It was just being in process with his art.
It was his oxygen.
Loved the best. Sorry.
Susanna, yeah. It was his oxygen.
Yes.
It was the way that we breathe and don't even think about it. That's the way he was with music. It wasn't so much a lot of times that he was even thinking about it. It just was just so in him, just running through him at all points and times. And that's what you experienced. And then when you got a chance to be around him, that's what you're experiencing. That's why when we talk about him, it's hard to even articulate into words because you haven't really been around anybody like that.
I know.
It's just so loves. It's just like breathing. It's just...
So no, it's funny. when you said the thing about scripture, like it is, I can love like the way a religious Jew would love the Talmud, or someone else would love the Old Testament or the New Testament. I listened to Prince lately, like this morning I went on my pandemic walk and I put on, and I just listened to a different Prince record all the time. And I listened to Diamonds and Pearls, which is later than the sort of a lot of the classic period people talk about. It's a little bit later, but there's a song Strolling, and I'm walking on Mulholland Drive, and this song is killing me. Like, and the thing is, it's like you can find beauty in a verse of, you know, of a religious scripture. Everywhere you go with his catalog, you can find gems that you, and learn something. Like musically, it really made me think, oh boy, I'm sure this is Prince's father's son, like the jazziness that was in him. Like there were all these directions that he got to explore a lot of them, but like you realize he could have done anything with his musical talent. He could have written, you know, I saw his ballet, which I think Misty Copeland was in, that he could have gone, and it's a shame that we don't have more, but it's so, I'm so thankful for what we do have. And I'm thankful, you know, that we got to celebrate, you know, his salute him on this Grammy special. I think we've run, I don't want to take too much of your time, but for Susanna and for Jimmy, the two of you who knew him better than any of us, just, is there one last story you want to share of what you love about the guy? Any memory from your time with him that stays with you before we let you go?
Well, Jimmy knew him much better than I did, but the moments of just standing on stage and smiling at each other and, you know, witnessing his supernatural magic, that was one thing. But also, I'm so grateful to the gift that he gave us of Manic Monday. I mean, he didn't even credit himself on it. The song was credited to Christopher. I'm just choked up thinking about what that has meant in my life, honestly, you know, and it was just so beautiful to be able to do that show with all of you, you know, with Jimmy, with you and David and everyone who put it together. And, you know, after he was gone, I just kept thinking so many times, and I had this actual conversation with Tom Petty, how many times, you know, you had that instinct to just reach out of the clear blue sky and just find a way to contact him. How many days I would be on my walks, and I would be listening to Prince, of course, and I would think, oh man, we were kids, you know, in the 80s, we were 20 somethings, you know, I need to talk to him. And I didn't. And I was actually on Tom's show and we talked about it. And he was talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame night and how he told me every detail of that night. And we were both feeling the same way. So I'm sorry I didn't, act on that impulse. But the night we shared, all of us who were part of that show, man, that was really profound for me personally as a human being and as a musician and as a Prince lover.
Susanna, can I ask you, did that happening and you not now being able to reach out to him, do you now reach out to people when you get that feeling like, I do too. So even in his passing, he's taught you something. And I feel the same way. I do that all the time. I'll hit somebody randomly or seek somebody out who I've always wanted to get to know and just never did. And now I'll look on Instagram or I'll try to find them and DM them or something. And I'll do that. And they're so shocked. And it's just like, yeah, but when Prince passed, that changed my outlook of things. It's like, I better let these people know how I feel about them.
100%. I mean, it's become a ritual. You know, whether it's just a finding them, as you just mentioned, on Instagram, or going through and sending someone just a heart emoji or something on a text. Yeah. And it just brightens up my day and it feels so good. So that really stuck with me as well.
Another life lesson.
Yeah. I mean, my Prince story is always the same. And so maybe people have heard it before, but it's one that speaks to the work ethic thing. And that was, when we were doing 7779311 and we were in rehearsals for that song, Prince came to watch the rehearsal, of course. So we do the song and we're thinking it sounds great. And when we stop, Prince goes, "Jimmy Jam, what are you playing with your left hand?" And I was like, "Nothing, Prince. I'm just doing a little bass line, you know. That's the only part I need to do." He said, "I want you to double the keyboards that Monty's doing, our other keyboard player. Double his part." And I said, "Well, it's not like that on the record, Prince." He said, "It's got to be better than the record." Okay.
Oh.
So now I'm playing my part, right? And I'm thinking, okay, cool. So we go through it. Song ends. He goes, "Jimmy Jam, what note are you singing on the chorus?" I said, "I'm not singing on the chorus, Prince. It's like a three-part harmony. And, you know, it's Morris and Jesse and Terry, and they got it, and whatever. Find a note."
Oh.
"But it's like not that on the record, Prince." He says, "It's got to be better than the record." Okay. So now I'm doing my part. So now I'm 7779311, and I'm playing both hands, right? We get done. He goes, "Jimmy Jam, why aren't you doing the choreography?" I said, "Prince, I'm standing behind a keyboard. What choreography? What am I supposed to do?" He said, "It's easy. You should be able to do it." So now I'm trying to do it. It was simple choreography. Right? It was a dance called the Four Corners from back in the day. Right? Simple choreography. So now I'm trying to do it, and I'm so frustrated because I can't. If I hit the dance and I miss the note, if I miss the note, then I miss the singing. Crazy. Totally drives me crazy. We go home after 5 hours of this. Next day, we walk into rehearsal. Prince walks in and he goes, "Okay, let's hear 7779311. And I just go, "No." We start the song, and about 2 minutes into the song, I realize that I'm doing everything that he asked me to do. I'm hitting both notes. I'm hitting my song, my note singing. I'm playing both hands. I'm hitting the choreography. So then I'm like, by the time we ran it a couple of times, now I'm taking my hanky out of my pocket and I'm doing my thing, my glasses, I'm taking my hat. And it was the most important lesson, but it was two things for me. It was one that he taught me about work ethic, about, no, you can do this, but also his belief in me. Like, I hated the way he told me to do it, but he saw something in me that I could do that I wasn't getting the most out of myself. And so he made me better. And I'll never forget that. I mean, that to me has kind of, that ruled my life really from everything after that, is thinking, no, you can do this, you know? And that's part of what made his mind so great, because he applied that same rule to himself. And that was, to me, part of his greatness.
Think about the ripples of that kind of lesson, because then Jimmy and Terry go off and become the, you know, the greatest production team of all time. And it just ripples. Like, he taught us all, and he's still teaching us all. We learned being around the music just doing the special. It's the education can continue.
Yep.
The special is so good, thanks to all of you guys. And it shouldn't just be one. You could do that special every year.
Yeah.
I mean, his legacy deserves it.
I agree. Well, I'm sure there will be more things done, and more things need to be done, you know.
Sorry, keep going.
No, I was just going to say, I'm very proud of it, of the special. I think Prince would be very proud, and I think musically it's so right on because it's such a diverse group of artists. Mm-hmm. And
can you mention some, can I mention some just so people know everyone from. You literally have everyone from, Foo Fighters, you know, rocking it really, really hard.
Killing it. So
beautiful, intimate performance by Chris and Susanna. To Juanes, representing a different whole musical world. To Gary Clark Jr. and her just, you know, kicking it off with this amazing version of Let's Go Crazy that I was worried, how can anyone else do Let's Go Crazy? The Time, you know, The Revolution with Mavis. I mean,
The Revolution is amazing. Yeah.
Beck doing, who I think kind of channels Prince and does Raspberry Beret. I hope, yeah.
And what about Earth, Wind, and Fire?
Oh.
Adore.
Yes.
Because, like, literally, Prince grew up loving Earth, Wind, and Fire. And to hear Philip Bailey hit that song, you know that Prince, and somewhere in his mind, as he's writing Adore, he's thinking Earth, Wind, and Fire. Like, he's thinking that voice. And absolutely. To hear them do it was amazing.
I thought Philip was unbelievable. The vocal is, and that song, which is like, again, I love that there's a lot of the classic hits. There's also a few, like, that's a deeper R&B radio favorite, like sort of Quiet Storm. And I think there are people who maybe don't know it that are going to discover it. There's Gary Clark Jr. does The Cross.
The Cross, yes.
Which is just another deep, deep moment.
Yes, so good.
And I, when I watched the special, because you know, Jimmy and I spent a lot of time in the edit bay, like one thing I love is now, especially with what's going on in the world, that Maya Rudolph didn't want to host in a jokey way. Mm. And, you know, thank God she didn't, because I love that this is a show that people can see now with a real audience, with people dancing together and being together.
Yes.
Shot two nights, you know, after the Grammys, you'll feel that sort of sense of the audience that Prince could hit. But you also just sort of, I think she brought a sort of seriousness about what Prince brought to our lives that feels right for now. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. No, me too.
I can't stop thinking about the story about hearing his boots on the floor and the vocal tracks, because it means two things. It means one, this late night guy who doesn't have time to go formally walk into the live room and have an engineer. He's manic about getting it done. And two, he's still dressed up alone at 4 a.m. in the studio.
At all times.
He had style.
He'd tell us that in the time. He'd tell us, he says, you guys can't go out in like sweatsuits and jeans or whatever. You guys never can wear that. You got to go out looking like yourselves. Like, it's got to be 100% all the time.
If he was on a Zoom call, he would have been dressed up.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And that's why I'm not Prince.
Hey, Suzanne, I got one last question for you. Sorry. So when you guys were at Sunset Sound, did he ever play basketball out there at the little hoop? They had that one little hoop.
Yeah, I mean, we had heard the lore about what a great basketball player he was.
Yep.
And so, because we weren't recording there, unfortunately, at the same time, but everyone would always talk about how great he was at basketball. So we knew that. And it was very cool.
There was that little basketball hoop they had at Sunset Sound.
Yeah.
And he would get everybody into playing games of horse, right? But he had all kinds of angles off the tree limb, off the roof, and into the basket. Like, he had the whole thing figured out.
Do you know the Chappelle sketch?
Nobody could beat him.
Have you seen the Dave Chappelle sketch?
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
But it's true. But it's pretty much true. That is pretty much it. And he would come, and he'd be in high heels. It wouldn't matter. But he could school you on the basketball court.
Yeah.
So in addition to being one of the greatest artists in history, also maybe the greatest 5-foot basketball player in, in Minneapolis history.
Yep.
Well, thank you.
Susanna, I'm sorry. I was just, one more question for you. Where is Manic Monday in the set? And does it move around, or has it had the same spot forever?
It's been sort of the third song of the set, you know, so for a long time. But I like moving things around. I'm in a mode right now where I like trying something in a different key and reinventing it. So, you know, actually back to the show, that being able to do Manic Monday with Chris that way was really, really special. But yeah, it usually is the third song.
Good.
By the way, and we don't care what critics think, but I've talked to a couple of music critics earlier today about the Prince special. And everyone is the moment that everybody is talking about is you and Chris. And I'm glad actually you said, because I wasn't sure, I couldn't remember how you guys came together to do it. But I know the last gentleman I talked to, that was for him, that was the moment. And he said, and I agree with him, you guys need to just put that out as a record.
I would love to. You know,
that version is just so incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. It went beyond what, I mean, I definitely wanted to cook something up with Chris that felt really special, but then, you know, that's good to know, because I was so emotional as I got in the car and drove home that night. And I remember thinking, and I think I texted Chris, I just had this really good feeling that if Prince had heard that, he would have liked it. Knowing what I know about Prince and my times with him, my experiences with him, hanging out with him, I just thought, and that made me feel so good. But you saying that makes me feel extra, extra good. Thank you so much for that.
Well, that's thank you all for being part of this. I really appreciate it. This is a one-off sort of event for a one-off artist. You know, there's only one of Prince, so I appreciate you all just interrupting your lockdowns for this.
Thank you for having us, David.
Thanks for letting you.
Lots of love.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. And if the elevator tries to break down,